From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain, filling in for Terry Gross. Virologist Dr. Mark Feinberg has been studying how HIV causes AIDS for the past 10 years. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Feinberg about what researchers do and don't understand about the virus and about their new research on how the virus behaves in long-term survivors. These are people who are HIV positive but haven't yet developed AIDS. Feinberg just returned from the International Conference on AIDS. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new psychological thriller, Color of Night. All that coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Florida's Governor Lawton Chiles has declared an immigration emergency. He's demanding federal help to cope with the hundreds of Cuban refugees streaming into Florida. It's the largest move of people from Cuba since the 1980 Mariel boatlift. Chiles says perhaps thousands of Cubans are massing on the Cuban shore, getting ready to flee to the United States.
To the people of Cuba, our message is simple. Please do not risk your lives on a very dangerous journey. The Castro government is clearly weakening and the day of freedom is near in Cuba. To the people of Florida, I want to say that we're going to do everything possible to make certain that our state is protected and that the federal government does its job and shoulders its responsibility.
Chiles is demanding that Washington begin an emergency plan for handling a refugee surge. Attorney General Janet Reno is warning against being melodramatic. She says the matter is being handled in an orderly fashion, but she also urged Cubans to stay home.
I want to work with all concerned, with the Cuban-American media and community, to make sure the message goes out to Cubans that putting a boat or raft to sea means putting life and limb at risk.
The White House says it won't permit another boat lift like the Mariel example that brought thousands of Cubans to Florida. The Treasury Department's general counsel has resigned. Jean Hansen's departure comes one day after President Clinton accepted the resignation of Deputy Treasury Secretary Roger Altman. He's been accused of misleading Congress with his Whitewater testimony. Hansen's resignation will take effect after the Senate confirms her successor. Her truthfulness had also been questioned by lawmakers in the Whitewater investigation. She was accused of failing to help Altman in correcting his testimony, much of which was later amended. NASA estimates it'll take at least 3 weeks before the space shuttle Endeavour can be launched. This morning's planned blastoff was called off at the very last instant. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has this report.
NASA officials say they suspect a faulty fuel pump may be to blame for this morning's failure to get Endeavour airborne. A temperature sensor measuring the gas created by liquid oxygen ran beyond safety limits for the pump. The problem was relayed to the shuttle's main computer, and the command was given to abort 1.9 seconds prior to liftoff. Initially, the sensor was thought to have been the problem, but officials are now concentrating their attention on the pump itself. NASA is faced with several options, which include installing a new pump if necessary, or a complete change out of the engines. Any scenario means that this year's remaining shuttle flight schedule may have to be reworked. Added to the equation is the possible effects of having at least one shuttle on the pad during hurricane season. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 18.5 points to 3,758. This is NPR. South African President Nelson Mandela has been in office for 100 days. Political violence has dropped since he was elected, but his administration is being criticized as too slow in delivering on its social policy promises. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Mandela himself invited assessments of his first 100 days, which have seen the start of only one new social program, free medical care for children and pregnant women. Other programs to build houses, create public works jobs, and investigate state crimes of the apartheid era are still under debate by South Africa's unity government. Despite the slow start, critiques of the new government have been gentle. Many South Africans say they understand that it will take years to uplift the black majority impoverished by apartheid. And while crime rates have soared, the fall in political violence has eased fears that South Africa could be torn apart by civil war. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
A federal judge says about 90,000 women have agreed to a settlement with breast implant makers. U.S. District Judge Sam Poynter Jr. is presiding over a hearing about the fairness of this plan. The hearing is being held in a theater in Birmingham, Alabama. That's because there are hundreds of lawyers involved in the case. Judge Poynter says fewer than 15,000 women have rejected the settlement, which provides more than $4 billion to cover reported health problems. If the plan is accepted, the women would receive payments ranging from $105,000 to nearly $1.5 million. A published report says the country's biggest movie theater chain is making new theater seats that move with special films. The Wall Street Journal says United Artists wants to give patrons the illusion of flight and other sensations. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. The 10th International Conference on AIDS concluded last week in Yokohama, Japan. It brought together scientists, public health officials, and activists, all of whom are working on various aspects of the fight against the disease. According to the World Health Organization, 17 million people are HIV positive. 4 million people around the world have developed or have died of AIDS, and the numbers keep growing. My guest, Dr. Mark Feinberg, attended the conference. He's been doing research for the past 10 years on the molecular biology of the HIV virus and how it develops into AIDS. He's an assistant professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at the University of California in San Francisco. He's also an attending physician at San Francisco General Hospital. Dr. Feinberg is involved with a study of HIV-positive gay men who seem to have defied the odds. For more than a decade, they were exposed to the virus but have yet to show symptoms of the disease. They're referred to as non-progressors or long-term AIDS survivors. We began with his impressions of the AIDS conference. I asked him if he found it productive.
From my point of view, it was. I know that many of the reports that appeared in the press were somewhat disappointed that there weren't any great breakthroughs announced. But in some ways, I think that really sort of reflects a maturing of those conferences. Of course, everyone wants there to be great breakthroughs, but given that the problem is so complicated, I think it's probably unrealistic to expect great breakthroughs, which is not to say that incremental progress is a bad thing, and there's no doubt that progress is being made.
One of the messages from the conference seemed to be, at least as I read it in newspaper accounts, that the focus should be on basic AIDS research. What does that mean for you?
Yeah, well, for me, that is what I do. I am involved in the study of the, trying to understand more about the basic mechanisms of how HIV works as a virus and how it causes the disease, AIDS. I think that sort of fundamental understanding is very important because this virus is very complicated and its interaction with the immune system within the body of an infected person is incredibly complicated, and our first pass at therapies, the sort of drugs like AZT and related compounds, haven't really worked as well as people would have wanted. And I think people really realize now that you have to go back to first principles, that we're going to have to understand more about the fundamental mechanisms of the disease process if we're going to really be able to make substantive inroads in terms of taking care of people who are infected with HIV.
Well, let's then get back to some of these basics. And what is then known about the virus? What do all researchers agree upon about this, what I think of as and has been described as a rather elusive and changeable virus?
It's not. I mean, to personify the virus, I think, is probably inappropriate. It is a virus that has a complex and I think incompletely certainly understood interaction with its host. We don't know a lot about it, but I think it's fair to say that we've learned more about this virus in the 10 years since its discovery than any other infectious agent that has ever afflicted human beings. What we know about the virus, I think there is little doubt that HIV is the cause of AIDS. I think we know a good deal about its genetic structure, and that is important to understand because that tells you what are the basic constituents and functions of the virus that it needs in order to replicate. And you really need to understand those if you're going to figure out ways of interfering with the virus's ability to replicate and grow. There's been a significant amount learned about those basic functions, although I think there's much more that needs to be learned before we'll be able to apply that basic understanding to actually coming up with new and better drugs, although progress in that area is being made. What we know about in the laboratory is a lot about how HIV grows and what controls its rate of growth, but what we really need to know much more about is about how HIV behaves in the body of infected individuals. And that's an area where I think a lot has been learned over the past few years, and really our concept of what the disease process is has been changed dramatically over the past few years. And that concept really determines how you're going to approach the therapy of the disease. For instance, a number of years ago, not that long ago, 3-4 years ago, the popular notion was among scientists, or at least among many scientists, that during the period of time that people were asymptomatic, when they were in this so-called clinically latent phase of the disease, which in many individuals can last 7 to 10 years or more, it was believed that there was very little virus replication going on and that the virus was somehow quiescent within the body of infected individuals. At some point, for reasons that were not known, it was believed that something turned on the virus replication, and with that, the immune system would deteriorate and people would become susceptible to opportunistic infections, the kinds of infections that people with AIDS suffer from. However, a number of research investigators have really clearly demonstrated that the replication of the virus is never truly quiescent within infected people, that it is going on all the time, and that what AIDS is probably the manifestation of the gradual damage to the immune system that has been manifest over a number of years. And that's really an important observation and an important lesson, because that suggests that really if you're thinking about intervening with antiviral drugs to stop the replication of the virus, you may well want to do it early in the course of the disease, early in the course of the infection, when someone's immune system is largely intact. And at that point in time, their own ability to fight the virus infection might be better. So you could actually use their immune system to help whatever effect that the drugs would be having in inhibiting virus replication.
I just want to go back to something that you said earlier just to make sure that I understood it correctly, which is that scientists know more about the AIDS virus than they know about other viruses?
I think that's fair to say, yes. You know, viral infections in humans have been much less successfully dealt with than many bacterial infections. Mm-hmm. There aren't, for instance, drugs like penicillin or the like for many virus infections. And in large part, that's because viruses are really intracellular parasites. They infect cells of the human body and grow within those cells. They basically use the normal cellular processes to their own advantage. Bacteria, in general, don't do that, and they have a very different sort of metabolism and different sort of genetic structure. If you're thinking about inhibiting a infection, you really need what's called a good therapeutic index, that the drug you use, you want to inhibit the replication of the pathogen, but you don't want it to damage the normal processes of the host cells, the human cells of the body. Yet if a virus is growing within the cell and using those cellular processes, your ability to have a good therapeutic index is limited because you basically get very close to inhibiting the normal cellular processes. So drugs that might inhibit virus replication might also be very toxic. So we need to identify ways of, you know, targeting functions that are specific to the virus rather than functions that are shared between the virus and the host cell metabolism. And that has been very difficult. And HIV, I think, is going to really be the test of this so-called new approach of rational drug design, where you have a target and your challenge is to design a drug that specifically inhibits that target but doesn't damage the normal host cells.
In your research to explore and understand how HIV causes AIDS, do you also then look at the immune system? Can you look at one without the other?
I think that's a very good question, and I think the answer to that is really no. Much, as I said, has been learned about how HIV behaves in the laboratory, how it behaves in cells in a tissue culture flask. However, in a tissue culture flask that, you know, people commonly study HIV replication in the laboratory, there is no immune system. In the body, the interaction between the virus and the immune system is critically important for the ability of the virus both to persist and cause a chronic infection in people, as well as the way that it damages the immune system. And it's quite clear that the immune system of infected people plays a very important role in containing the replication of the virus. In many individuals, it ultimately seems to fail, but it's very active and it's trying very hard. What's particularly frustrating about HIV infection, but I think from a scientific point of view is also quite fascinating, is how intimately linked the replication of HIV is to the normal functions of the host immune system. In many ways, its biology, how it grows, what regulates its expression, has really co-opted the normal regulatory mechanisms mm-hmm. that are used by cells of the immune system to do what they do.
Let me run a quote by you and tell me if you think this is right or not, something I ran across, saying that the AIDS virus makes the immune system kill itself. Would that be an accurate description as you best understand it?
No, I would disagree with that.
Okay.
I think the AIDS virus, HIV, exploits the normal regulatory mechanisms involved in generating immune responses that are protective to allow itself to cause a persistent infection. It basically is using the immune system's own mechanisms in many ways to evade the clearance of the virus infection by the immune system. It's, in a way, adapting its ability to be turned on and turned off by the normal mechanisms that are involved in generating immune responses to, in effect, on one hand, hide from the immune system so that there are cells in infected people that harbor the HIV virus but are not expressing it at any one point in time. So, in essence, they leave no footprints or fingerprints for the immune system to recognize and get rid of those infected cells, and thus they can cause a infection that the immune system can't get rid of. Yet when the immune system encounters a foreign substance, so-called antigen, in the environment, it has cells that get activated to respond to that foreign substance. And in order to do that, it sets off a specific program of cellular signaling that alters what those cells of the immune system do and activates expression of certain functions that are going to carry out those necessary roles. HIV, amazingly enough, has adapted the same sort of responsiveness to those signals that the normal genes of the immune system use to be activated. So whenever the immune response is activated and infected cell is activated, the virus is turned on and can then come out and infect other cells.
Well, it sounds like a very cagey virus. I mean, that's a very non-medical term, but that's what it sounds like what you're describing.
It has a very intimate relationship with the immune system. There's no doubt about it. And I think it can be viewed really as a double-edged sword. On one hand, it uses the normal mechanisms of the immune system to be turned off so that it can, in essence, hide from clearance. And on the other hand, it uses the normal mechanisms of the immune response to be turned on and, in effect, at that point will damage the cells that are going to be responding to foreign substances in the environment and probably preferentially damage those. So what may be going on in an infected individual is not just that they're losing their so-called T4 or CD4 positive T cells, the ones that really are critical to regulating the immune response in a random way. It's that you may be losing them in a specific way, and it may be the ones that are you need the most, the ones that are responding to foreign substances that are common in the environment that are lost earliest in the course of the disease.
My guest is Dr. Mark Feinberg, and we're talking about the research that he is doing in AIDS, and he just got back from the AIDS conference in Japan. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Mark Feinberg, and we're talking about some work that he's doing in AIDS. Well, let me shift gears slightly here. And I know that there's a group of people infected with the HIV virus, with the AIDS virus, who have defied the statistics. The statistics being that usually it takes about 10 years for an infected person to develop full-blown AIDS. These are people who have lived beyond those statistics, and I believe they are called non-progressors.
Yes.
What percentage of people infected with HIV could be described as non-progressors?
It's probably on the order of magnitude of around 5% of individuals. Part of our inability to be more specific about that is that the HIV epidemic isn't that old. At least our awareness of the epidemic isn't that old. So the people who have been identified as these so-called long-term non-progressors or long-term survivors have been people who have just been followed since, say, 1979 or so. Really, only time will tell what the exact percentage of the people who can sort of survive long-term HIV infection without developing disease and whether these people will be able to live out their natural lives or whether they will ultimately develop AIDS just with a longer period of time between their initial infection and the development of the disease.
Do you think it's important, though, to study healthy people? Is that important to the understanding of the AIDS virus?
I think it is important, but I think I would probably say it in a somewhat different way. I think it's important to study people who have very different manifestations of HIV infection. For instance, there are some people who develop AIDS within a year or so after their initial HIV infection, and then there are other people who seem very healthy without really any evident damage to their immune system after, you know, 13 or 14 years of infection, and then the majority of people are somewhere in between. I think if we're really going to understand the fundamental mechanisms, you know, by which HIV causes AIDS, namely what contribution does the virus play to the rate of progression of the disease? What contribution does someone's immune response to the virus play in containment of the disease? We need to really analyze, I think, in some detail, people who have all these different manifestations of HIV infection.
Well, I know that you're involved in a long-term study in San Francisco, there's a fairly large group of gay men who are being studied as part of this investigation. What are you looking to understand about this group of people that seem to defy the statistics?
Well, they are being characterized from a number of perspectives because, to be quite honest, starting out to study these people, we don't know which variable is going to be the relevant one in determining why they're healthy after so many years of HIV infection, or whether, in fact, it's going to be the same variable in each of the individuals. When you approach a group like this, you can ask a number of questions. You can ask about the virus that they're infected with. And I think actually before you start with that, you ask whether they're still infected with the HIV virus. You try to identify whether the strain of HIV that they happen to be infected with is somehow what we would call less pathogenic, less
a weaker form.
A weaker form. That's correct. Alternatively, you ask whether their immune response to the virus is somehow more effective than an individual who's going to be following a more typical course of disease progression, namely developing gradual signs of T cell depletion and the appearance of identifiable defects in their ability to respond to foreign substances in the environment, and ultimately their susceptibility to getting infected with things that people with intact immune systems don't get infected with. So those are really the questions. I think, is it the virus or is it their immune system?
And what's the longest of those long-term non-progressors? You said 1979. Would that be 15 years then?
Yes.
So at this point, the end point is 15 years, and you don't know whether these people will be survivors or not because you don't know if in a year they might develop symptoms.
Well, it probably differs between different individuals in the group. Some workers in the field have criticized the study of this population because they say, well, with any normal biological process, you would expect a sort of distribution, a so-called normal distribution that, as you may remember from your high school biology classes, follows a sort of bell-shaped curve.
Right, I remember that.
Okay.
Very well.
They have said that, well, maybe these people are simply at the sort of tail of that distribution, one end of the bell-shaped curve. And if that's the case, you would think that these people would not be particularly interesting to study. It would just be a random event. If it's a random event, you would expect that some of these people will develop AIDS with time. However, what we've seen in studying them is it is probably that some of these people really do have something special about them, something special about their ability to contain the HIV virus. And they have been really quite stable for a long period of time, and it's very difficult to say whether they ever will develop AIDS. You know, some of them may, but it looks like some of them are really sort of rock stable in terms of their immune system. We can really predict progression to AIDS in many ways by looking at someone's CD4 helper T cell count. That usually falls at a specific rate in a given individual over time, and the rate of decline really predicts whether they're going to develop AIDS in the relatively near future or not.
We'll hear more from Dr. Mark Feinberg in the second part of the show. He's been doing research on how the HIV virus develops into AIDS, and he just returned from the International AIDS Conference in Japan. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
from Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. A small and significant percentage of HIV-positive individuals haven't developed AIDS. There are also groups of people who, even though they've been exposed many times to the HIV virus, haven't become infected. Coming up, we continue our discussion with virologist Dr. Mark Feinberg. He's been studying the virus for 10 years and just returned from the 10th International Conference on AIDS. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Color of Night, starring Bruce Willis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Florida Governor Lawton Chiles says the federal government should help his state deal with a tidal wave of Cuban refugees. He's calling on the Clinton administration to develop an emergency plan. But Attorney General Janet Reno says she doesn't think emergency steps are needed yet. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The Coast Guard has been picking up several hundred Cuban refugees a day this week in the waters off Florida. But Attorney General Janet Reno believes the influx has been manageable and it's not placing too much of a burden on the state. She says federal immigration officials and relief volunteers have the situation under control.
They are able to resettle and relocate people with their families, and they are making provision to relocate people who do not have families outside Florida. I've talked with people who have been visiting at the Catholic Charities Center, making sure that there's no bottleneck and that it is being processed.
Reno did urge Cubans not to risk their lives in unsafe boats, saying there are legal and safer ways to come to the U.S. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The Space Shuttle Endeavour's launch will be delayed by at least 3 weeks. The orbiter was supposed to take off today, but computers aborted the launch at the last possible instant. A fuel pump had overheated. Launch engines were shut down, and water was sprayed on the shuttle equipment to cool it off. A NASA spokesman says all 3 Endeavour engines could be replaced, and that could take several weeks. This is the 5th engine shutdown on the launch pad in shuttle history, but none has been so close to launch. 2 children were flown back to New Jersey today from Jordan as part of a custody fight that's involved officials at the highest level of government in the U.S. and Jordan. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
The custody battle began 6 weeks ago when Muhammad Abiqua fled to Jordan with his 2 children. 2 days later, police found the body of Abiqua's wife, Nahal. He's confessed to killing her and is facing murder and kidnapping charges. The children, ages 3 and 6, were flown back to the U.S. in the custody of their maternal aunt. She was granted custody after Jordan's King Hussein intervened on her behalf under pressure from the U.S. State Department. Mr. Abiqua's family in Jordan had also sought custody and was waiting for a ruling from an Islamic religious court. The U.S. has been pushing for Mr. Abiqua to be extradited to the U.S. to stand trial, but since the 2 countries don't have an extradition treaty, the Jordanian government has refused to turn him over and has promised a speedy trial in Amman. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
The government reports the U.S. trade deficit fell slightly in June to $9.3 billion. The Commerce Department says the gap in goods and services was more than 1.5% below May's level. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost more than 21 points to end at 3,755. This is NPR. Federal mediators are holding separate talks today with Major League Baseball players and team owners. The meetings are an attempt to break the deadlock between the 2 sides as the players' strike enters its 7th day. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
A team of mediators showed up this morning at the office of Major League Baseball in Midtown Manhattan. After meeting for several hours, they walked the 3 blocks to player union headquarters to speak to officials there. Mediators would say little to reporters waiting outside as they went in. The strike by baseball players is now a week old, and the 2 sides remain far apart over the issue of whether a cap should be placed on player salaries. There have been no face-to-face meetings between the 2 sides since last Friday. team owners and players agreed to submit the dispute to mediation last week, but both sides have said they aren't optimistic it will help much. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Anti-abortion activist Paul Hill has pleaded innocent to charges of murdering an abortion doctor and his volunteer escort in Pensacola, Florida. The former Presbyterian minister allegedly carried out the shootings last month. He's also accused of attempted murder in the shooting of the escort's wife, June Barrett. Hill has advocated the concept of justifiable homicide, that's the killing of doctors who perform abortions, to prevent abortions from being done. His trial is set for January 30th next year. Fire officials in Central California say they're getting help from cooler temperatures and more humidity. The big blaze in San Luis Obispo County has charred more than 48,000 acres and dozens of homes. Firefighters have surrounded almost all of the fire, and they expect to contain it by Monday. Fire officials in Utah hope to save the Bear Mountain Ski Resort, which is threatened by a fire near Logan. A resort owner says the fire has already burned down some ski runs. In Washington state, firefighting efforts are winding down. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our conversation with Dr. Mark Feinberg. For more than a decade, he's been doing research on the molecular biology of the HIV virus and how it causes AIDS to develop. Dr. Feinberg is also tracking the virus in a study of HIV-positive gay men in San Francisco who've been asymptomatic for more than 10 years. Do you know if anyone's ever beaten the virus?
Well, that's a good question. If it ever happens, it's incredibly rare. To my mind, there are no good documented cases of anyone ever having cleared this virus. I think one aspect of this that's commonly neglected in the discussion is very important to me personally in terms of how I think about this. There's been lots of speculation and lots of uncertainty about where the AIDS virus came from in the first place. And in order to investigate that, people have looked to see whether there are similar viruses that are present in other non-human primates, various species of monkeys, other apes like chimpanzees, what have you. And in fact, in many of these species that are living in the wild, in various regions of Africa, you can identify viruses that are clearly related to the HIV virus. And what is really fascinating is that in these animals, some of them are called pseudomangabees. There are others called African green monkeys. They harbor HIV-like viruses throughout their lives and seem to suffer no negative consequences of that. They seem to be perfectly happy in essence, coexisting with this virus infection. And I think it will be important to understand how these viruses seem to cause them no harm. What's particularly interesting is if you, say, take one of the viruses from an animal called a pseudomangabee, which that pseudomangabee wasn't suffering any ill effects from, and infect another species of monkey with that same virus, a rhesus macaque, the rhesus macaque will develop a syndrome that is almost identical to AIDS in humans. So on one hand, the same virus seemed to cause no problem in one species of animal, yet causes AIDS in another. And it may well be that the reason why HIV causes AIDS in people is because that this virus infection is new to human populations. With any virus infection, it's unusual, if not really kind of unheard of, that 100% of the people who are infected with a virus will develop some sort of disease. So HIV, in fact, seems to cause disease in a greater percentage of people who are infected with it than most other viruses, but we really have no reason to say at this point in time that it's going to cause disease in 100% of the people. And it may be that these long-term non-progressors have some way of coexisting with the virus. Either their immune system can contain the virus better, or even if the virus replicates, perhaps it doesn't damage their immune system.
What about some of the intangibles, like a person's diet? And we're talking about non-progressors. A person's diet, a person's lifestyle, the quality of their life, their their happiness states. Do you think that has any effect whatsoever on the progression of the disease?
Those are obviously very important questions, and I think ones that are of interest to everyone who's infected with HIV and all the people who care about people who are infected with HIV, because, of course, one would like to be able to make recommendations to people about how they might be able to change their lifestyle to improve their health. And I think if those things exist, it's very important to know about it. To date, there's not been any clear indication that that really is the case. And I'm kind of concerned about people saying, well, if you adopt a positive attitude and resolve all your conflicts, then you'll live longer with HIV. Because for many people, it's the biology of the disease process that's really going to, in many ways, determine their fate. And I would feel very bad to see someone really sort of feel not only bad that their disease was progressing, but feel guilty that if they had somehow adopted a different approach to handling their life, that they would have done better. I think that can be a very dangerous thing. I think also, though, that people should be encouraged to make positive changes in their lifestyle. I really think that everyone infected with HIV should take active efforts to do what they can to protect their health. And I think they should work to, you know, also optimize their emotional state of health, because whether they're going to be a long-term non-progressor or whether their disease is going to progress, I think they will be much better able to deal with their fate if they, you know, have resolved many of the difficult issues surrounding the disease or, you know, just surrounding their life in general.
Do you feel frustrated with this disease? You've been working for 10 years, and I'm just curious about your quality of life and your attitude towards it. Do you feel like you're losing the battle?
I don't think we're losing the battle, because I didn't think that the battle would be so easily won. I think it's an essential battle to fight, but if you're going to do that, you have to decide that you're in it for the duration. If I felt like there was no progress being made, I would be very frustrated. But I feel that there's a lot of progress being made. It's not progress at the rate that I would like. You know, on one hand, in the laboratory, I can be very excited about how much is being learned by myself and my colleagues around the world. Yet on the other hand, when I go to the clinic and see people who I care a great deal about becoming progressively sicker and many of them dying, the rate of progress is obviously not fast enough to help them, and that's very frustrating. But I don't think one can just throw up their hands in despair and say, well, I'm giving up on this. I think that there's a lot of work to be done, and I think it's essential that that work continue. I know that the sort of public optimism or pessimism about HIV and AIDS is sort of on a roller coaster and sort of oscillates between people thinking, yes, we're going to have a quick cure, or no, we're never going to have a cure or a vaccine. And I think the reality is somewhere in between. We are making progress, and little by little, I think we will continue to improve the quality and quantity of the lives of people who are infected with HIV, and hopefully things will accelerate. But I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
My guest is virologist Dr. Mark Feinberg. More in just a few moments. This is Fresh Air. My guest is AIDS researcher Mark Feinberg. Let me get a reaction to you from a criticism that I've heard voiced more than once, in that the amount of money going into AIDS research is sucking away money that could go into other forms of research. the kind of work that you do and what you learn about the AIDS virus, is this information that can be transferred to other conditions? Are you solely learning things about AIDS, and what you learn will have nothing to do with medical progress anywhere else?
Yeah. Well, I know that is an important concern, and I have very strong feelings about that. It really gets back to the notion about how any sort of research impacts on any other sort of research that might take place in the future. And I guess to give you a little background, it's probably fair to say that you really never know where one research finding is going to have application in the future. It is quite clear that however horrible the HIV epidemic may be, if it had occurred, say, 20 or 30 years before it did, it's quite possible that we would still not know what the cause of the disease was, and that we would have probably absolutely no, even partially effective, treatment for it. And the reason why we were able to learn so much about HIV in such a short period of time is really a lot of research that had taken place in fundamental aspects of biology in the preceding decades that had nothing to do with HIV or AIDS, but from things that were as far afield as studying how bacteria replicate or how the viruses that infect bacteria replicate, and really gave birth to the whole field of so-called recombinant DNA technology. With the recombinant DNA technology, we were able to learn a tremendous amount about HIV in an incredibly short period of time. To ask whether we've learned anything by studying HIV that will have impact in other areas of biology or medicine, it's quite clear that we have. For instance, there are a number of functions that have been studied in the HIV virus that were really discovered for the first time, that the HIV virus, in order to regulate its expression and replication, does a couple of specific functions that were never known to occur in human cells before. And it's very difficult to imagine that the virus is just doing them on its own, but that it's just using a pathway that had existed for regulating the expression of normal cell functions. And I think there's a lot of work going on now to figure out how those work and what those might be in the regulation of normal cells.
Where now are you going to focus your efforts, having just come back from the conference and certainly in continuing your work with AIDS? Where are you going to address your efforts?
Well, I think we still have much more to learn about how the virus behaves in infected people. We need to know more about how it's causing this persistent chronic infection, and we need to know more about the precise details of how the virus damages the immune system. The emerging evidence, which I think is quite strong, is that it is actually the level of virus replication or growth in an infected person that is directly damaging the immune system. And an important corollary of that is if you can somehow find ways of effectively interfering with virus replication, you might really benefit the health of people who harbor the virus. And I think the real challenge now is to make the average individual who's infected with HIV more like one of these long-term non-progressors. And the best way that we can approach that now is by trying to find out better ways of using the antiviral drugs that we now have, working as best and as fast as we can to develop better drugs. And really, I think, you know, applying recent lessons about monitoring the amount of virus replication that's going on in infected people to guide our therapies. And that's an important area that has only recently become possible.
Do you find as a researcher and also as someone who deals directly with AIDS patients that you wear two very different hats?
I do wear different hats that I try to make look like one, because I think that in reality, there's an important role for people who do wear both of those hats, because one of the important things is really communication and people trying to span the different disciplines. And, you know, really one area can productively inform the efforts in another area. And if I can contribute in that way by, you know, sort of inconveniently wearing two hats, I'm happy to do so.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Dr. Mark Feinberg is an assistant professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at the University of California in San Francisco. He's also an attending physician at San Francisco General Hospital. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about all things considered today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. Coming up in Florida, the governor there has declared a state emergency because of the increase in immigration from Cuba. Florida is asking the White House for help. Mara Lyson reports on White House efforts to win new support for the federal crime bill. Joe Richmond, a reporter, has the story about a blood bank that is holding a singles night with a pint of blood being the price of admission. We'll have an update on the health care debate on Capitol Hill with Elizabeth Arnold. And I'll talk with Rachel Liebling, a filmmaker, about her documentary on Bill Monroe, the man who 50 years ago created bluegrass music.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When director Richard Rush suffered a heart attack while making his new film, it was only the latest in a series of woes that have beset his career. His last movie, The Stuntman, was an enormous critical success in 1980, but it had taken him 10 years to make it. And he hasn't managed to make a movie in the 14 years since until now. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Color of Night.
If I were a congressman, and don't worry, voters, that's not in the cards, I would have spent the last week working to add a small amendment to Clinton's crime bill. Mandatory sentencing for Hitchcock imitators. Take Richard Rush, for instance. He's a terrific director, and Color of Night is a work of real craftsmanship, but none of that matters as you wince your way through his attempt to conjure up the spirit of Hitchcock's masterpiece, Vertigo. Instead of suffering from a dizzy fear of heights, the way James Stewart does in Hitchcock's movie, Bruce Willis suffers from an inability to see the color red. That's because he's a shrink who feels responsible for the death of one of his patients. She leaped out a skyscraper window in the middle of a session with him, and the pool of red blood that formed around her shattered body made Willis instantly colorblind. Still, that's the least of his problems. When he gives up his practice and goes to L.A. to recuperate at the fancy home of a friend and fellow shrink, the friend is brutally murdered. The main suspects are the members of the victim's Monday night therapy group. In other words, one of the patients may have killed his own analyst. And when Willis decides to take over the group in his friend's place, he starts getting mysterious threats himself. On top of all this, he meets a mystery woman, played by Jane March. She's a childlike nymph who insinuates herself into his life, but won't tell him anything about hers. When the two of them aren't making mad love in swimming pools, they're having dinner table conversations, like this one.
There's something about me that I bet you find a little strange, right?
What is that?
Well, I haven't asked what you do.
That's right. You showed remarkable restraint.
Well, it's because I'd rather guess. You know, I actually get upset if someone tries to tell me before I can figure it out for myself, you know?
But what if I'm ashamed of what I do?
Why? Why would you be ashamed of being a shrink?
Who told you I was a shrink?
Well, are you?
How did you know?
It's the way you look at me, you know?
How do I look at you?
You have this kindness in your eyes. But I think that you're using it to keep me away. You know, you're trying to play it safe, trying to see me as a case instead of as a female.
From just that little bit of evidence, you can tell this is not exactly deathless screenwriting. It's even worse for those of us who guessed the solution to the film's big mystery about an hour before we were supposed to. The plot is a lot less tricky than it hopes to be. Still, If Color of Night is a bad movie, it's nevertheless an oddly entertaining one. Bruce Willis and Jane March both give pallid, uncomfortable performances, but the members of that Monday Night Encounter group are all splendid actors, among them Brad Dourif, Leslie Ann Warren, and Kevin J. O'Connor, and their ravings are a lot of fun. Better still is Reuben Blades, who plays the standard crotchety detective role with more crotchets than Peter Falk ever dreamed of. And then there's Richard Rush himself. Color of Night has some jerky editing and a laughably terrible score, but the world of shifting perspectives that Rush creates, by shooting through glass and in mirrors, and by making his camera stalk and glide like a prowler, all that is mesmerizing, despite the foolishness of the story. Richard Rush will never be Hitchcock, but that's just fine. I can only hope that some studio gives him a chance to be himself before another 14 years roll by.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberto Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, stand-up comic and performance artist Marga Gomez. Her one-woman show, Memory Tricks, is about her flamboyant showbiz parents and her mother's decline from Alzheimer's. And we'll hear from novelist Ben Cheever, son of the late writer John Cheever. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.